Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today has long studied the impact of too much international debt. Throughout the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, he observed financial disasters in Europe, Latin America, Asia, and Russia. But Harvard professor Jeffrey Frieden never thought he'd see his own country, the United States, become the biggest international borrower in world history. That unfortunate milestone occurred in 2008 when more than two-thirds of our nation's federal debt was held by foreigners. And this staggering figure led Frieden, along with his colleague Menzi Chin, to dig deeper into why this happened, what the impact was, and ultimately how the nation might emerge from this. The result is their new book called Lost Decades, The Making of America's Debt Crisis and the Long Recovery. Jeffrey Frieden joins us in studio. He's in the state as part of the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire's series called Primary Concerns, Critical Foreign Policy Issues at the Ballot Box in 2012. This hour on The Exchange, international debt, lessons learned, and how much is too much. Let's hear from you too this hour. How big a problem do you think this is? Does it matter if our debt is held by Americans or foreigners? And what'll it take to get out of this debtor status that our nation finds itself in? Give us a call, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And Professor Frieden, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Well, and before we get into the who, what, when, where, why, you know, the title itself, Professor Frieden, when the first decade of this new millennium began, it was sometimes called the lost decade, you know, going up from 2000 to 2010. The title of your book with Menzi Chin, though, is Lost Decades, plural. Are we in danger of losing another 10 years?
Unfortunately, I think we are. We certainly lost the first decade of the millennium or of the century. We had relatively slow growth from 2001 to 2007, and then, of course, that was completely wiped out by the recession that ensued. At this point, we've started on a new decade, and the real fear is that the recovery from the debt crisis, the crisis that began in 2007, has been so slow, and the threat of a double dip or a new recession is so great that we might lose the next decade.
Now, we've got a whole 8 years until the decade is out, but you're already nervous enough to mark this whole next 8 years.
Very nervous, and in part, it's because we have experience with debt crises of this type. Their studies have looked at 150, 200 debt crises over the past several hundred years, and they take a lot longer to recover from normal recessions, cyclical changes in economic activity, typically between 5 and 8 years.
This comes from your experience studying other nations. Again, as I said in the introduction, nations that, you know, are sometimes unflatteringly called banana republics and, you know, countries in Latin America or Africa. How does their experience inform what you're looking at now with the United States?
Well, although there are massive differences among countries, and the United States is not Brazil or Turkey or Russia, the fact is that the process of foreign borrowing and its implications for a domestic economy are quite similar among countries. The U.S. has been a large borrower. It is now a large borrower again. And my co-author Menzi Chin and I have studied many, many debt crises over the past 25 or so years. And we started seeing in the early part of the decade, back in 2003-04, like many other scholars, that the U.S. was going through an experience that looked a lot like that of other borrowers, whether it was Mexico or Brazil or Turkey or Thailand.
Those countries that the IMF used to wag its finger at and say, you're borrowing too much, watch out.
Exactly. And we worried, as many did, that the U.S. was going to get itself into trouble with this massive borrowing. And of course, it did. So the sad part of that is the experience also told us that if a borrowing experience goes bad and a country enters into a debt crisis, it typically does not end well, that there are massive economic and political problems that ensue. We don't look forward to those problems, but I think we have to confront them because that's the reality that we face.
Well, and let's step back now, if we could, and really just pretend we're an Econ 101, Professor Frieden, if we could, please. First of all, just this idea of foreigners loaning to us. First, on the federal government level, How do foreigners come to acquire U.S. debt, and why is that a problem? Does it really matter if the holders of U.S. debt are Chinese or German or Turkish or whatever?
Well, foreigners buy American debt. Foreigners lend to the U.S. government the same way Americans lend to the U.S. government. They buy Treasury securities. The principal source of demand for Treasury securities over the past 10 years or so has been from foreign governments, although there are also lots of foreign private investors, German private investors, banks, French banks, Dutch pension funds, and then the Chinese government, the Korean government, the Japanese government, and in many instances, the governments of oil-rich countries that have money that they are not going to spend and therefore want to invest. So you ask whether it matters that foreigners own the debt. At some level, a moral or ethical level, it doesn't really matter. I mean, we're borrowing the money and we can use the money for whatever purpose we would like. The way in which it does matter is that when it comes time for the debt to be paid off, when you're paying off foreigners, the money is leaving the country. So those are resources that the country as a whole has to generate and send abroad.
I see.
When we're paying ourselves off, if I borrow money from you or if the federal government borrows from us, it pays us off. We spend the money in the United States, so the money stays inside the country. So the point is that for a government or a country to pay off a foreign debt, it has to actually generate a surplus that it can send abroad. That's the problem, for example, the European debtors face today. Greece has to cut back on not only government spending, but personal spending, household spending, corporate spending, in order to generate money to send to the countries that it owes money to.
Okay, so on the individual level, Professor Friedan, you say in the book, Americans borrowed trillions of dollars from abroad to allow themselves to consume beyond their means. If I'm taking a loan out from a bank, whether it's, you know, my local bank or Bank of America or Wells Fargo or whatever, and I'm using it to finance a house, how, again, does that constitute me borrowing from abroad? And again, what's the problem with me borrowing from abroad?
Right. Well, the way it worked in the Treasury securities is pretty straightforward. Foreigners
sure.
buy them directly. The way it worked in the mortgage market specifically, and actually also in the credit card, student loan, and consumer loan market, is that those loans are then taken and packaged and sold on financial markets. So you might take your mortgage, my mortgage, another 998 mortgages, put 1,000 mortgages together into a big bond, which would be worth whatever, you know, $1 billion or something along those lines. And it's sliced and diced, turned into securities, turned into things that people can buy, and foreign investors buy those bonds. There are also more direct ways. A foreign bank might have a subsidiary in the U.S. For example, the Royal Bank of Scotland owns Citizens Bank, and Citizens Bank lends the money, and the profits go to Royal Bank of Scotland. Or a foreign bank might lend money to an American bank, which then on-lends to American mortgage holders. But the most important way over the course of this most recent borrowing boom was what's called the securitization of mortgages. That is, taking these mortgages, turning them into securities that people could buy and sell, and then selling them to foreigners. So when an American bank lent you your mortgage, it was getting the money originally and then selling the mortgage to a foreign investor in many instances.
So is the bottom line the same as when foreign governments are buying up U.S. debt, that ultimately when that debt is repaid, it goes somewhere else outside our borders and, you know, we could really use the profits and investments right here?
Sure. If your mortgage is held by a German bank or a British bank, and your mortgage payments go to that German or British bank.
Now, you say in the book there's nothing necessarily inherently wrong with international borrowing and lending. I mean, you say in our history we've gone into international debt before, and in some instances that was great for our economy. I think there's even a quote from Alexander Hamilton himself in the book.
Right. Alexander Hamilton, who was one of my heroes among the founding fathers, said that a national debt, if well managed, can be a national blessing. And I believe that. There's nothing wrong with borrowing in general, and there's nothing wrong with a country borrowing. Firms borrow all the time. People borrow all the time. For a country, like for a firm, the point is that it only makes sense to borrow if the money that you're borrowing is being used to make the country more productive and more efficient so that it can pay off its loans. If you borrow, as we did in the 19th century, we were the world's biggest borrower for 100 years. The canals, the railroads, many of the factories, opening up the prairies, that was very largely financed by foreigners. And in fact, the revolution was largely financed by foreigners as well. The Dutch lent us a lot of money to fight against their enemies, our common enemies, the British. So borrowing for productive purposes is no problem. And in fact, you mentioned the IMF wagging its finger at the Mexicans and the Brazilians and the Turks. The IMF and the U.S. government and many of us long said to poor countries, to developing countries when they were borrowing, don't borrow to run budget deficits you can't justify. Don't borrow unless the money is going to productive purposes. Don't borrow for consumption alone. What we did between 2001 and 2007 is we borrowed between $500 billion and $1 trillion every year, and almost the entirety of that money went into consumption. In fact, our investment actually went down in that period as a country. The money was spent on consumer goods, on a federal deficit, which ballooned in that period, on a housing bubble, a financial bubble, on what you might think of as a consumption spree. So we borrowed precisely along the lines that we had advised other countries not to, that is to finance current consumption and not to increase the productive capacity of the country. And that's the problem.
I want to dig into that with you for sure. But our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, Jeffrey Frieden is here, a professor of government at Harvard University. He's co-author of the new book called Lost Decades, The Making of America's Debt Crisis and the Long Recovery. His co-author is Menzi Chin. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. How big a problem do you think this indebtedness is? Especially that much of this debt is held by foreigners. And what do you think it'll take to get our country out of this debtor status? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. So it's okay to borrow from foreigners if you're using it for productive investments, railroads, canals, factories, or whatever. Some people would say, Professor Frieden, hey, you know, a housing boom is a productive investment that yields returns for the individual who owns that home, creates jobs in the construction sector, the real estate sector, the carpet laying sector, the curtain making sector, you name it.
Well, demand or increasing economic activity is not necessarily always productive. And I certainly wouldn't deny that some of the money that was borrowed went to make the country more productive. There is an argument that homeownership is good for social stability, for people's sense of belonging in a community. This was, in fact, a line that the Bush administration was very interested in over the course of this period. Homeownership is good socially, politically, economically. The problem is that the United States is not lacking for homeownership and for housing. It is lacking for other things. There are other things that we could be investing in that could make us more productive. Homeownership is not necessarily a bad thing to be investing in, but it's certainly not a priority. The second problem is that in much of this period, what was being invested in was not the construction of new housing, but the turning over or the churning of assets in a housing bubble and a financial bubble and a credit bubble more generally. So when it's real investment, that is when the real stock of housing is rising, you can make an argument that some of that is justifiable. I'd say not all of it. Housing's not the best investment, generally speaking, for a rich country such as ourselves. But much of the investment was going into speculation in a housing bubble, or a boom and then a bubble, as it later turned out to be. And that really is not productive at all.
And we'll get into the federal deficit side of this after a very short break. We'll take your calls, too, so join us, 1-800-892-6477. We're going to check in now real quick with our end-of-the-year fund drive.
Thank you, Laura. This is our very short end-of-the-year drive. I'm Abby Goldstein, in charge of programming, and with me is our president and CEO, Betsy Gardella. And we're asking you to make a phone call right now to 1-888-805-6477. Before we close the calendar on 2011, you can make your tax-deductible gift of support to New Hampshire Public Radio. Think about paying it forward to 2012. 1-888-805-6477.
Abby, this year, The Exchange celebrates its 15th anniversary. The show has covered virtually every topic that matters to us as residents in the state. Thought leaders like former Justice Broderick and Dr. Jim Squires, political analyst Dante Scala, Dean Spiliota's commissioners George Bald and Nick Tumpas make this program essential listening every day. I think of The Exchange as our kind of collective kitchen table. It's where we gather each morning to talk about the issues that affect our lives, healthcare, the economy, energy, the environment. And in this political season, we'll continue to book the candidates as they visit the state to answer your questions.
So you can call us right now to support the exchange at 1-888-805-6477 or make your gift at nhpr.org. And, you know, you got me thinking, Betsy, we make a special commitment here at New Hampshire Public Radio to covering the issues that are important to us, specifically in the Granite State. And, you know, the exchange has been here for 15 years because people have stepped up and supported it in the past. And your support right now helps keep that kitchen table conversation alive and well for many years into the future. Consider becoming a member of our leadership circle, because really you're making a special commitment to these locally generated conversations, this original programming that we're able to produce here with your financial support. As a membership, a leadership circle donor at the $100,000 level, you're showing your commitment to these important local conversations. 1-888-805-6477. What did I say? $1,000. That's the leadership circle level. I got myself confused, Betsy.
Although $100,000 would be a really welcome gift. So if anybody was contemplating that, you just go right ahead.
That would be a great tax thing.
Well, for everyone who contributes this morning, they are eligible to win the Kindle Fire, and e-readers have become very popular. But what some listeners may not know is that you can bring your Kindle Fire to your public library to download books. There's also an app that allows you to purchase books from other sources besides Amazon. So it's a really nice thank you gift for you or perhaps a friend or family member for the holidays.
Very nice. 1-888-805-6477 is the number to call. And, you know, you hear a lot about books in conversations on the exchange. Every year we do our summer reading program. At the end of the year, we will do kind of a best of books of the year with our local booksellers. Today's author, Jeffrey Frieden, with his new book about America's debt crisis. This is New Hampshire Public Radio is a place where you hear about the latest books, and we know that you are voracious readers. So make that gift today and support this public radio station. Think about the books on your shelf. How many of them have you read based on something you heard on NHPR? Make the call right now, 1-888-805-6477, and get your donation in before the end of the year. Make it count on your tax deduction.
For many of us, December is a time when we count our blessings. We reflect on the year that's passed, and we look ahead to the new year. I know that New Hampshire Public Radio is your constant companion, your trusted source, and I hope you'll take a minute to contribute right now. Your gift will help us stay strong in 2012, and that number is 1-888-805-6477.
Or you can go online to nhpr.org and make your tax-deductible gift online. And really, most sincerely, thank you.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from PSNH, a sponsor of the Environmental Protection Agency program, New Hampshire Home Performance with Energy Star. Information at psnh.com/home performance. And the Riviera College MBA program, helping career-focused professionals connect to the future today with an MBA. Riviera College in Nashua, online at riviera.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with the co-author of a new book called Lost Decades, The Making of America's Debt Crisis and the Long Recovery. Our guest is Jeffrey Frieden. He co-wrote the book along with Menzie Chin. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. As we look at the issue of foreigners holding the bulk of American debt, how big a problem do you think this is? Does it matter if our debt is held by Americans or those from other countries? What do you think it'll take to get our country out of its debtor status? Should cutting back be a priority right now, given the sluggish economy? We'd love your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477 is the phone number. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Professor Frieden, just before the break, we were talking about how, you know, borrowing from abroad isn't necessarily bad. In the old days, we borrowed from abroad to finance the American Revolution, to finance the railroads, the canals, the factories, the Industrial Revolution, and so on. Jump up now, if you could, to modern times, and usually measured post-World War II, you know, right. 50s, 60s. What was the U.S. attitude toward debt 50 or 60 years ago, both personal and public debt? And when do we start to see those attitudes change?
Well, I think generally speaking, coming out of the Depression, there was a belief that financial markets had to be regulated pretty firmly, because a lot of the analysis of what had happened after 1929 was that the financial system had failed us. Instead of being something that aided the economy to run more efficiently and allowed people to engage in more productive economic activities, it had sort of pulled the entire American economy and the world economy down with it. So we had a spate of regulations which were intended and largely did reduce the risk of serious financial crises. At the same time, there was a feeling that too much debt was a problem. And in fact, we had borrowed very heavily, of course, to finance World War II. Much of the early post-war period from 1946 or 7 on up until really the late 60s was engaged in reducing the burden of the federal debt. And we ran surpluses, really, or at least were in balance through much of that period in order to allow us to pay off the debt that we had accumulated over the course of World War II, which we did. The federal debt as a share of GDP declined continually over those 20 or 25 years.
So there's a conservative attitude both at the government level and at the individual level that, you know, debt is not a good thing. I remember doing layaway. I want that dress. It's too expensive. I'm going to give the store, you know, 10 bucks a week until I can pay it off.
Right. Well, and people don't really remember. I don't really remember. But credit cards are a relatively recent innovation.
Oh, absolutely.
1960s really is when credit cards start being proliferating. And housing mortgages were much, much more difficult to get 50 or 60 years ago than they are today. Now, I have to say, having a conservative attitude towards debt, feeling that it's not a good idea to borrow, is not necessarily a good thing, because to some extent it had to do with the fact that the financial system was constrained. And it is good for people to be able to borrow if they're going to be able to pay back the loans. There's nothing wrong with a financial system that channels funds from people who have money but don't want to spend it to those who don't have money and would like to borrow to spend for the future. So there's nothing wrong with that. The problem that we faced really starting in the 80s, is both at the federal government level and to a certain extent at the personal level. There came to be the view that, as it was sometimes expressed, deficits don't matter. That it doesn't matter if the government runs deficits, because we'll always be able to borrow. It doesn't matter if people, households, run deficits, that is, borrow very heavily, because the financial markets will lend anyone everything. And that is, it's not true. Deficits do matter, both personal and federal. And it's also not true that the government and people can borrow infinitely, that the financial markets will lend us as a country and us as individuals as much money as we want.
Let me just jump in real quick here and ask you something that's from the book, this idea that deficits don't matter. We heard that from both political parties in that sort of 80s, 90s period. One of the arguments that was thrown back when people said, well, hey, you told Latin America not to do it, you know, you told Africa not to do it, why can you do it? In other words, run huge deficits. Was that, and it sounded convincing, America's different. Our economy is so dynamic. Our financial markets are so free and dynamic. You know, the dollar is a world currency. So there's this idea of American exceptionalism, and that means deficits don't matter. Here, Latin America, you get your act together, but we don't need to because we're different.
Well, there's a certain amount of truth to that in the sense that the U.S. economy is the world's largest economy, and it's a very dynamic economy, and foreigners do want to invest in the United States. The problem is that running deficits, federal deficits, let's say, if we're thinking about the federal government, running a federal deficit is not necessarily something that's associated with making the country more economically productive, efficient, and attractive. Just because we can borrow the money doesn't mean we should. Right. So it is true that because the dollar is the world's currency, because the U.S. is the world's largest economy, foreigners are a lot more interested in lending to our government than they are in lending to, say, the government of Somalia, if it had a government. But that doesn't mean that our government should borrow just because it can. It also doesn't mean, as we have found, that individuals should borrow just because they can. You have to be able to identify a productive purpose to which the money is being put in order to justify borrowing. So I'd say that although the U.S. is different from Turkey or Thailand, the principles are the same. Thailand shouldn't borrow unless it's using the money well. We should not borrow unless we're using the money well.
It's hard to define well. I mean, we talked earlier, some people think housing is a great investment. You talk in the book about how some of the borrowing went to finance the war in Afghanistan. Well, at the time, a lot of folks felt like, you know, look, they didn't hand over the Taliban. They attacked us. They sheltered Al-Qaeda. Yeah, it's expensive, but we have to go to war. So there's a little bit of a subjective nature to saying borrow well.
To an extent. But focusing on the federal debt for or federal borrowing for a moment, I think our point would be not that federal spending or the wars or social spending or Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security are bad things, but that if the American people decide that they want the government to do certain things, such as increase our sense of national security or increase our sense of social security, they should pay for it. We have gotten ourselves into the bad habit of demanding things from the government without being willing to pay for them. Now, you can argue on either side of that. You can say we should demand less from the government. We should spend less on national security. We should spend less on homeland defense. We should spend less on Medicare, Medicaid, social programs. Or you can say, no, we want those programs. They're very popular. People like them. Well, then we should pay for them to finance our national security or our social programs entirely heavily by borrowing. I think it's not – first of all, I don't think it's right. And secondly, I don't think it's sustainable. In fact, I know it's not sustainable. We can't possibly continue to run deficits ad infinitum. No one can.
We're not willing to make the choices, the taxation or cutting back the spending.
Right.
So we've found this easy third way of, you know, China and Saudi Arabia,
sure,
perfectly happy to lend us the money.
Right. And that third way, in a sense, became the third rail. So we found an easy way to avoid hard choices. But eventually, it came back to haunt us. And to an extent, drawing some parallels here, think about what's going on in Europe today. The southern European countries found an easy way, once they joined the euro, to avoid their hard choices. And they're in a much more difficult situation because they're not – Greece is not the U.S. It doesn't issue a world currency. Spain is not the U.S., Italy. The problems they're facing are in many ways directly parallel to the problems the U.S. faced. That is, instead of making the hard choices over the course of the last decade, they chose to postpone those choices and to borrow their way out of the choices. And now they're being – their feet are to the fire and they're having to do it in terrible, terrible circumstances. I would hate to see that happen to us. But the prospects – it's not out of the question that we would face problems similar to those that the southern European countries are facing.
Not out of the question.
Not out of the question to the extent that at some point it may be the case that foreigners start looking at the U.S. and saying, it's not such a good bet anymore. Now, to an extent, we're benefiting by the rest of the world's troubles because if investors look around the world, where would you rather put your money? Would you rather put your money in Europe? Well, maybe not. Would you rather put it in Japan? Well, not so much. So there aren't a lot of options. But at some point, perhaps the Europeans will get their act together. The euro may look more attractive. Japan and the yen may look more attractive. China may look more attractive. Other countries may look like more attractive places to lend money to. I don't think it's conceivable that the U.S. can continue to run these massive deficits ad infinitum and expect foreigners to finance them without ever getting any prospect of being paid back.
Again, our number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Again, today in the exchange, we're talking with the co-author of a new book called Lost Decades. It looks at the political, economic, global roots of the U.S. financial crisis and also this issue of borrowing from foreigners that we're facing now. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Jeffrey Frieden co-authored the book along with Menzi Chin. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. So we're not willing to make the choices. Lucky for us, foreigners have financed it so far. At some point, though, the house of cards comes crashing down. Or has it, Professor Frieden, already come crashing down in the form of the financial crisis that we saw in 2008?
Well, yes, to an extent, because it's forced us to start making some of those choices. At this point, it's true that we can continue to borrow. But I think Americans recognize that our appetite for borrowing is limited, that our willingness to continue to borrow as a country or as individuals is strictly limited. So we do have to make choices. We do have to adjust. We're in the process of adjusting as a country. That is, we're in the process of trying to put our house in order.
I'm not really seeing a lot of activity. I'm seeing a lot of fighting and a lot of talking.
Okay. Well, I'm being optimistic for a change and positing, or at least supposing, that a lot of the discussions that are going on are about how we are going to adjust. And in a sense, so I guess I would say that looking forward, three, five, 7 years, we are going to have to adjust. Eventually, the government is going to have to do something about the deficits. Eventually, as a country, we're going to have to do something about the fact that we are continuing to borrow from the rest of the world. We're going to have to get our house in order. What's happening, I think you're absolutely right, what's happening now is what always happens after a debt crisis, is that people are arguing over who's going to have to pay for it.
Right.
There is this massive conflict, whether in the U.S. or in Europe or elsewhere, about who's going to pay to deal with the mess that's been accumulated. This debate, these conflicts, are both within countries and across countries. So in Europe, we see the Greeks versus the Germans, the Dutch versus the Spaniards. In the U.S., to some extent, it's us versus the Chinese. That's one way the conflict addresses itself or it presents itself. But then there's also conflict within countries. Who's going to pay within the U.S.? Is it going to be taxpayers? Is it going to be the financial system? Is it going to be managers or workers or government employees? Those are battles that are being fought. And the reason I'm, I guess, guardedly optimistic is simply that those battles are being fought about what we're going to do to get out of this crisis. So yes, we are gridlocked and yes, we are polarized, but we are arguing about how to deal with the problems that we face.
Let's take a call.
Hopeful. I'm hopeful.
I appreciate that. Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. And from Westmoreland, James is calling. Hi, James. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us. James from Westmoreland, are you with us? Okay, James, I hope you call back. The number again, 1-800-892-6477. So one more question on this sort of, here we are, day of reckoning, we've borrowed too much, our deficits are too big, at least we're talking about it. If this borrowing had taken place, borrowing to finance the deficits, which you argue were not spent on productive purposes, if this had been this money had been taken from Americans instead of Chinese or Saudi Arabians or Germans, would it matter as much that we were running huge deficits?
Well, it would have had very different implications, very different effects. So again, remember, $5 trillion are coming into the country over this time, and that increases our spending on things. And two of the things that it does is we increase spending on imports, so our trade deficit skyrockets. And there are broad effects of that as Americans are faced with more and more competition from foreign goods. And the second thing it does as money comes into the country is that there's more spending on things like housing so that the price goes way up. If it had been entirely domestic, and this is a very sort of a strange hypothetical circumstance, but if it had been entirely domestic, it probably would not have had the same effect on the housing and financial booms and bubbles that we have seen. To put it somewhat differently, in virtually every debt cycle that we observe, foreign debt cycle that we observe, you see the same things we see in the U.S., a big trade deficit and a big run-up in the price of housing. And that's because money is coming into the country. And so it has to be lent out. The banks with $5 trillion more to lend out, they lend it out and have to lend it out somewhere. They lend it out typically for things like housing, credit card debt, and things along those lines. The other aspect of this is all this money coming into the country inevitably reduce the average quality of loans that the banks were making. So banks now have a lot more money to lend. They don't lend to people who've already borrowed as much as they want. They lend to riskier borrowers. So it puts the financial system at greater risk.
I still don't understand from that answer why this would be different if it were Americans financing that debt instead of foreigners.
Well, if you want to think of it in this way, think of the U.S. as an entirely closed economy, which it was largely until the 70s, let's say. For us to borrow that money from ourselves, we would have to be the lenders, that is the people buying it, would not
I
be
see.
Spending it on something else.
I see. So
it's
you
not,
lent to me,
right,
and so
I can't spend that money.
We're sort of a zero-sum game.
Exactly.
When it comes from outside, it's just a wash of cash
that's
coming
right.
in.
So if the federal government borrows $1 trillion from Americans, that's $1 trillion Americans can't spend on something else. If the federal government borrows $1 trillion from foreigners, that's an additional $1 trillion spent on the domestic economy.
Got it. And after a very short break, we will start taking your phone calls. So stay on the line or join us at 1-800-892-6477. We'll check in very quickly now with our end of the year drive.
I think the exchange covers such a wide variety of topics. It's not just political, it's not just technical or environmental or social issues that she covers, but it's everything that's going on, whether it's local or whether it's national or even at times international. She does a very good job, Lorcanoy does a very good job of bringing different views together without anyone feeling as though there's, you know, conflict or getting slammed or that kind of tone.
Kate Bartlett is a listener and a contributor to NHPR from Henniker.
I'm Betsy Gardella, and I'm here in the studio this morning with Abby Goldstein, and we're taking just a few minutes to ask you to consider a year-end tax-deductible gift to NHPR, and you can do that by calling 1-888-805-6477 or by going to nhpr.org.
You know, we've been talking a lot about the attributes of the programming that you hear on New Hampshire Public Radio, and the exchange is really about depth. This is not a quick hit, not a short 3-minute conversation about a topic or an issue. This is an in-depth discussion about the history of the debt crisis today, a pretty big and meaty topic. And each day, the exchange will take a single topic and take a deep dive into the details and explore all these multiple angles and take your calls. And being able to spend an hour on a single topic, really poking at all the different facets, is a great service to you. And it gives you the ability to broaden the way you think about those issues. And your support helps make it possible. 1-888-805-6477.
You know, we could not do the exchange without you. We tee up the conversation, and then we turn it over to you. It's your questions, it's your insights that bring these conversations to life. And your contributions make this statewide conversation possible. It's a simple equation, money in, radio out. Just call 1-888-805-6477 or go to the website and make your tax-deductible pledge.
NHPR.org. And, you know, this drive is a little bit different, Betsy. We're trying kind of an experiment here with our extremely short end-of-the-year drive. You may have noticed that we haven't mentioned anything about a thank you gift today. We don't have thank you gifts during this drive. It allows us to put more of your donation back into the programming that you value. We do, however, have drawings. So each day during this very short drive, just a few days, you'll have the chance to win something. And today our drawing is for a Kindle Fire and a $200 Amazon gift card. So when you make your gift before 7 o'clock tonight, you'll be entered to win that Kindle Fire and that Amazon gift card. 1-888-805-6477.
You know, a membership to NHPR would make a wonderful gift as well.
Yeah.
And for $100, that gift could include a member card with discounts at restaurants and shops and performance venues across the state. You know, in my family, stockings are a big part of our family tradition, and I think a year of great radio would make a terrific stocking stuffer.
That would. 1-888-805-6477. It's a great idea. This year on the exchange, we've been celebrating the 15th anniversary, and we did the exchange yearbook, looking back at an issue for each of the 15 years that the program has been on the air. We've done special a series like Socrates Exchange. It's a chance for you to really hear something different on the exchange. It is a program that is here for you every day. And now we're asking you to be here for us at the end of the year. 1-888-805-6477 is the number to call. You can make your gift at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Cambridge Trust Company of New Hampshire, building lasting relationships and providing thoughtful, independent investment, trust, and wealth management services, CambridgeTrust.com. From the New Hampshire Lottery since 1964, contributing more than $1.4 billion to education. And the Palace Theatre in Manchester, continuing a holiday tradition with Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, December 2nd to the 23rd. Tickets at palacetheatre.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're talking with co-author of a new book that looks at how the U.S. became the biggest international borrower in world history. The book is called Lost Decades. The co-author is Jeffrey Frieden. His other author is Menzie Chin. We're taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Frieden, I think James is back with us from Westmoreland. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Yep, hi.
Go ahead, James.
Okay, am I on now?
You are on now. Please go ahead.
Oh, okay, I'm listening to the radio, and it's different timing. My question is that we're going to soon hear all these political parties with their blame on each other, and I'm just wondering if there's any depth to that conversation, anything that we can learn of value, you know, about what blame there is.
Absolutely, James. No, it's a good question, and we're hearing a lot of the blame game already. Go ahead, Professor.
Right. Well, I think there is value in trying to figure out why the crisis happened as it did. I think value in the kind of superficial blame game that we often see is perhaps not so great. But I think it is very important to understand how and why we got into the situation that we're in. I would like to see more discussion of the early origins of the crisis. What were the relative roles, for example, of the federal deficits, of laxity in financial regulation, of attitudes towards housing or home ownership more generally? I think it's important for the American electorate to understand how the choices that were made over the past decade affected the crisis. People tend to lose track of the fact that this crisis was 10 years in the building. It didn't happen all of a sudden in October of 2008. It hit the headlines at that point, but there was a lot going on in the 10 years leading up to the crisis. And both to try to figure out who has the best resolution or solution to the crisis and to avoid getting into a similar crisis in the future, I think it's important for Americans to understand where it came from.
Well, and Democrats often blame the Bush administration for running up deficits. And you and Mr. Chin in the book say that that administration does bear much of the responsibility, along with the housing and the banking and so forth that we talked about earlier, and along with Congress, which didn't exercise restraint and its power of the purse. Remind us, Professor Frieden, what was the mindset of that administration and that Congress in running up deficits, especially when Republicans traditionally pride themselves upon being the party of fiscal restraint?
Well, in many ways, it's very bizarre because you did have 6 years of completely Republican control of both the presidency and Congress after 2001. And as had happened in the 1980s, this Republican, traditionally fiscally conservative party ran the biggest deficits in peacetime history. There were a number of arguments. One argument was, as we were saying before, that deficits didn't matter now that we could borrow money from the rest of the world. Another argument was a more purely political one, which you often heard and still sometimes hear. There's this theory in among many Republican activists called starve the beast. That is, that if you build up deficits, it will force the government eventually to cut back. Because as the government becomes more and more heavily indebted, it presents future generations of politicians with the necessity of cutting back, which is in fact what's happening. Another, a more partisan interpretation of this was, well, if a Republican government builds up big deficits, then the Democrats come in, they can't spend as much. So one can't know exactly. Karl Rove and others are on record actually arguing that this starve the beast point, this political point, was what they were thinking. But that, of course, wasn't the entirety of it. There was also – there was a brief recession in 2000, 2001, and the idea then was that deficits would help get us out of the recession. So there was a combination of the desire to get the economy going again, but also the political or partisan desire to try to tie the hands of future governments.
Well, and I remember talking to Republican members of Congress at the time and saying, hey, what about the deficits? You know, you complained about them under Clinton. Now you're saying they're okay under Bush. And they would say to a person, look, after 9/11, the world changed and it's all about national security and we just can't worry about deficits right now. Is that a valid argument? It is expensive to protect this huge nation from terrorist threats.
Absolutely. And there was an increase in government spending after 9/11, but the deficits didn't really come from an increase in government spending. The deficits came from the tax cuts. I mean, we were running a surplus. In 2000, we ran the fiscal surplus of the federal government was almost $250 billion. And if things had continued, we would have paid off the entire government debt within 6 or 7 years. So it was the tax cuts of 2001 and 2003 that drove us into the deficit, not spending. We could have increased all the spending that we needed on national security without running a deficit at all if the tax cuts had not intervened. So I think that argument really doesn't play out. There might be good reasons to cut taxes at certain points to stimulate the economy or things along those lines, but the level, the extent, the length of the tax cuts implemented in 2001, 2003, and their effects on deficits, I think, were a very large part of the problem.
And as you said earlier, it's not so much, you're almost not critiquing the politics behind these decisions. Let's increase spending. Let's go to war. Let's cut taxes. You're saying, fine, great, dandy, but pay for it.
Right. Well, there are times when deficits are justifiable. And I think today, for example, would be one of those times because we're in such a deep, deep and difficult set of economic circumstances. But a government cannot run deficits over the long run without facing the consequences. And that's what we were not doing. We spent, I mean, again, we ran major deficits in the 80s until 92, 93, and then spent almost 10 years in the 90s. Very difficult period with a bipartisan agreement eventually to bring the deficits down. And we did.
Bill
we
Clinton
succeeded.
And Newt Gingrich.
That's right. Clinton and Gingrich, much as they may have despised each other, they worked together and brought the deficits down so that by 97, 98, we were running surpluses. That was incredibly difficult. And it was all dissipated in the course of a few months.
Got lots of calls, Professor Frieden. Let's take another one. Bruce sure. is in West Lebanon. Go ahead, Bruce. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I was interested in your panel's perspective. It seems like, you know, money being the driver of all things, particularly in the instance where we borrow from countries like China, it seems like one of the unintended benefits of having such a large debt with a country like that has been that in situations where, they would be less likely to come to the table to discuss important matters, the fact that we, they need us, we need them because, obviously the level of debt that they or investment that they have in the U.S. versus what we owe them seems to make us strange bedfellows. And I'd be interested in your perspectives on that.
You know, that is a great question, Bruce. Thank you very much.
Yes. Well, Bruce, you're absolutely right. Keynes once said, if the bank lends you $1,000, I think he said pounds, but anyway.
He was British, right.
That's right. If the bank lends you $1,000, you're its debtor. If the bank lends you $1,000,000, you're its partner. And so in a sense, we and the Chinese are partners. They are owed a massive amount of money by Americans and in particular by the U.S. government. And so they have a very important stake in the U.S. economy.
Does it give them sway over our foreign policy?
Well, I don't think it gives them sway at this point because the U.S. still is by far the world's largest economy. But it does mean it does mean that to a certain extent we are in it together. It's not just the debt, of course. It's also that they are a massive trading partner. We have investments in China. They have investments in the U.S. So this is, in a sense, this is a microcosm of globalization. The fact that the U.S. and China and the American and Chinese economies are so intertwined and so interdependent means that they can't really do a lot without affecting us. We can't do a lot without affecting them, which is a very strong argument for trying to work together to resolve some of these problems.
Well, maybe it's not such a bad thing then. If China's an emerging global power and we're a little concerned about their emerging military spending, but we're tied together in this uncomfortable waltz, maybe that's okay. Maybe that's a recipe for global cooperation on the economy and on peace.
Well, that may be, but there are probably better ways to elicit global cooperation than to become indebted to the entire world. So I think we already are tied together with much of the world economically and tied together with China. I think that there really is a significant issue between the U.S. and China over their investment in American securities and the fact that they are, in some sense, one of the major sources of our ability to run these deficits. I think it's not good for us, and I also actually think it's not good for them.
Well, the argument has been made that they should be investing that money in their own country, given the extreme poverty that you still see in rural China.
Exactly. I think that the Chinese strategy of throwing everything into exports to the U.S. and to Europe primarily, has been tremendously successful for the country as a whole. But the success has not been very evenly distributed. And I think the Chinese are very aware of this. I mean, there's a real sense in China that there has been too much emphasis on producing goods for export and not enough on the domestic market, on building up their infrastructure, on increasing domestic demand, on increasing the stability and vitality of their own national economy.
Well, real quick, Professor Frieden, because I have to wrap it up with you, and I'm sorry that I have to, because there's a lot more we could talk about, but you hinted at this. Let's go there. What's the way out of this? I mean, some people say, great, cut back on the deficits. I hear you in the long run, but in the short run, we might not want to do that because it will have a depressing effect on our economy.
Well, I think that's right. I think it's very important to separate the short-run problems from the long-run problems. The short-run problems really are about the extremely slow recovery. We have a very high unemployment rate. We have very long-term unemployment. We have an economy that is not really picking up. It's growing at very slow rates. So I think in the short run, it would be a big mistake to put on the brakes, and the government should be doing things to try to keep the economy growing. To try to address the deficit overnight would be a mistake. It would, as in 1937, drive the economy into another recession. recession. But in the long run, we have some very, very serious problems we have to confront. The first is fiscal. We clearly have to get our fiscal house in order. Over the next 15 or 20 years, we face an impending crisis in Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. And one way or another, we have to learn to and get used to paying for the social spending that we want. So on the fiscal front, we clearly have to deal with the impending difficulties in Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security by increasing taxes, by reducing benefits, by some combination of those two things. I also think we have to really pay attention to restoring the vitality and stability of our financial system. The American financial system today really is not working. It's not doing what
still,
it should be.
Even
it's
after
still
all
not doing.
Through.
No, it's not doing what it's supposed to. It's working for maybe for the bankers, I suppose, and the banks are not bankrupt, at least not in reality, but it is not playing the role that a healthy banking system plays, which is making capital available to entrepreneurs, to small businesses, to homeowners who need it. The banks are not willing to lend because they're in such deep trouble, and we have to get the financial system going again by revising regulation, by stabilizing the monetary system, by stabilizing the financial system.
Well, lots more we could go into. Thank you so much for being here. It was a real pleasure.
Well, it was my pleasure, Laura.
That's Jeffrey Frieden, a professor at Harvard, and the book he co-authored with Minzy Chin is called Lost Decades, The Making of America's Debt Crisis and the Long Recovery. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
And we invite you to make a gift during our extremely short end-of-year drive. Good morning, I'm Abby Goldstein, and I'm here with our president and CEO, Betsy Gardella. And the number for you to call to make that that gift during this end-of-year drive is 1-888-805-6477.
Yeah, Abby, at the top of this hour, I'd like to take a moment to just think about the issue of trust. Trust in media in general is at an all-time low, and trust in public media continues to grow. Shows like The Exchange and The Diane Rehm Show, which is coming up in just a minute, are such great examples of what public radio does best. Background and discussion of topics that matter, multiple viewpoints, and incredible guests. Not all the conversations are easy. I think of Diane, for example, as being tenacious but always gracious. Mm-hmm. Two descriptors that don't necessarily go together, but she keeps the conversation real and so often asks the questions that I would were I in her host chair. If The Exchange and The Diane Rehm Show are essential items on your media menu, please give us a call this morning.
1-888-805-6477 is the number to call. Or you can make a gift online at nhpr.org. And, you know, I want you to think about that as an investment in the kind of conversations that you hear every day. This is not just give us your cash. You are investing in public radio here in New Hampshire. And you get the return.